Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. All Things Considered by G. K. Chesterton. Section 10. Wine When It Is Red. I suppose that there will be some Whigs on the green in connection with the recent manifesto signed by a string of very eminent doctors on the subject of what is called alcohol. Alcohol is, to judge by the sound of it, an Arabic word like algebra and Alhambra, those two other unpleasant things. The Alhambra in Spain I have never seen. I am told that it is a low and rambling building. I allude to the far more dignified erection in Leicester Square. If it is true, as I surmise, that alcohol is a word of the Arabs, it is interesting to realize that our general word for the essence of wine and beer and such things comes from a people which has made particular war upon them. I suppose that some aged Moslem chieftain sat one day at the opening of his tent and brooding with black brows and cursing in his black beard over wine as the symbol of Christianity, racked his brains for some word ugly enough to express his racial and religious antipathy, and suddenly spat out the horrible word alcohol. The fact that the doctors had to use this word for the sake of scientific clearness was really a great disadvantage to them in fairly discussing the matter. For the word really involves one of those beggings of the question which make these moral matters so difficult. It is quite a mistake to suppose that, when a man desires an alcoholic drink, he necessarily desires alcohol. Let a man walk 10 miles steadily on a hot summer's day along a dusty English road, and he will soon discover why beer was invented. The fact that beer has very slight stimulating quality will be quite among the smallest reasons that induce him to ask for it. In short, he will not be in the least desiring alcohol. He will be desiring beer. But of course the question cannot be settled in such a simple way. The real difficulty which confronts everybody, and which especially confronts doctors, is that the extraordinary position of man in the physical universe makes it practically impossible to treat him in either one direction or in the other in a purely physical way. Man is an exception, whatever else he is. If he is not the image of God, then he is a disease of the dust. If it is not true that a divine being fell, then we can only say that one of the animals went entirely off its head. In neither case can we really argue very much from the body of man, simply considered as the body of an innocent and healthy animal. His body has got too much mixed up with his soul, as we see in the supreme instance of sex. It may well be worthwhile uttering the warning to wealthy philanthropists and idealists that this argument from the animal should not be thoughtlessly used, even against the atrocious evils of excess. It is an argument that proves too little or too much. Doubtless, it is unnatural to be drunk. But then, in a real sense, it is unnatural to be human. Doubtless the intemperate workman wastes his tissues in drinking, but no one knows how much the sober workman wastes his tissues by working. No one knows how much the wealthy philanthropist wastes his tissues by talking, or in much rarer conditions, by thinking. All the human things are more dangerous than anything that affects the beasts: sex, poetry, property, religion. The real case against drunkenness is not that it calls up the beast, but that it calls up the devil. It does not call up the beast, and if it did, it would not matter much. As a rule, the beast is harmless and rather amiable creature, as anybody can see by watching cattle. There is nothing bestial about intoxication, and certainly there is nothing intoxicating or even particularly lively about beasts. Man is always something worse or something better than an animal, and a mere argument from animal perfection never touches him at all. Thus, in sex, no animal is either chivalrous or obscene, and thus no animal ever invented anything so bad as drunkenness or so good as drink. The pronouncement of these particular doctors is very clear and uncompromising. In the modern atmosphere, indeed, it even deserves some credit for moral courage. The majority of modern people, of course, will probably agree with it in so far as it declares that alcoholic drinks are often of supreme value in emergencies of illnesses. But many people, I fear, will open their eyes at the emphatic terms in which they describe such drink as considered as a beverage. But they are not content with declaring that the drink is in moderation harmless. They distinctly declare that it is in moderation beneficial. But I fancy that in saying this, the doctors had in mind a truth that runs somewhat counter to the common opinion. I fancy that it is the experience of most doctors that giving any alcohol for illness, though often necessary, is about the most morally dangerous way of giving it. Instead of giving it to a healthy person who has many other forms of life, you are giving it to a desperate person to whom it is the only form of life. The invalid can hardly be blamed if, by some accident of his erratic and overwrought condition, he comes to remember the thing as the very water of vitality and to use it as such. For in so far as drinking is really a sin, it is not because drinking is wild, but because drinking is tame, not in so far as it is anarchy, but in so far as it is slavery. Probably the worst way to drink is to drink medicinally. Certainly the safest way to drink is to drink carelessly, that is, without caring much for anything, and especially not caring for the drink. The doctor, of course, ought to be able to do a great deal in the way of restraining those individual cases where there is plainly an evil thirst, and beyond that, the only hope would seem to be in some increase, or rather some concentration, of ordinary public opinion on the subject. I have always held consistently my own modest theory on the subject. I believe that if by some method the local public house could be as definite and isolated a place as the local post office or the local railway station, if all types of people passed through it for all types of refreshment, you would have the same safeguard against a man behaving in a disgusting way in a tavern that you have at present against his behaving in a disgusting way in a post office, simply the presence of his ordinary sensible neighbors. In such a place, the kind of lunatic who wants to drink an unlimited number of whiskies would be treated with the same severity with which the post office authorities would treat an amiable lunatic who had an appetite for licking an unlimited number of stamps. It is a small matter whether in either case a technical refusal would be officially employed. It is an essential matter that in both cases the authorities could rapidly communicate with the friends and family of the mentally afflicted person. At least the postmistress would not dangle a strip of tempting sixpenny stamps before the enthusiast's eyes as he was being dragged away with his tongue out. If we make drinking open and official, we might be taking one step toward making it careless. In such things, to be careless is to be sane, for neither drunkards nor Moslems can be careless about drink. Demagogues and Mystagogues. I once heard a man call this age the age of demagogues. Of this I can only say, in the admirably sensible words of the angry coachman in Pickwick, that that remark's political, or what is much the same, it ain't true. So far from being the age of demagogues, this is really and specially the age of mystagogues. So far from this being a time in which things are praised because they are popular, the truth is that this is the first time, perhaps, in the whole history of the world in which things can be praised because they are unpopular. The demagogue succeeds because he makes himself understood, even if he is not worth understanding. But the mystagogue succeeds because he gets himself misunderstood, although, as a rule, he is not even worth misunderstanding. Gladstone was a demagogue, Disraeli a mystagogue. But ours is specially the time when a man can advertise his wares not as a universality, but as what the tradesmen call a speciality. We all know this, for instance, about modern art. Michelangelo and Whistler were both fine artists, but one is obviously public, the other obviously private, or rather, not obvious at all. Michelangelo's frescoes are doubtless finer than the popular judgment, but they are plainly meant to strike the popular judgment. Whistler's pictures seem often meant to escape the popular judgment. They even seem meant to escape the popular admiration. They are elusive, fugitive. They fly even from praise. Doubtless many artists in Michelangelo's day declared themselves to be great artists, though they were unsuccessful. But they did not declare themselves great artists because they were unsuccessful. That is the peculiarity of our own time, which has a positive bias against the populace. Another case of the same kind of thing can be found in the latest conceptions of humor. By the wholesome tradition of mankind, a joke was a thing meant to amuse men. A joke which did not amuse them was a failure, just as a fire which did not warm them was a failure. But we have seen the process of secrecy and aristocracy introduced even into jokes. If a joke falls flat, a small school of aesthetes only asks us to notice the wild grace of its falling and its perfect flatness after its fall. The old ideas that the joke was not good enough for the company has been superseded by the new aristocratic idea that the company was not worthy of the joke. They have introduced an almost insane individualism into that one form of intercourse which is specially and uproariously communal. They have made even levities into secrets. They have made laughter lonelier than tears. There is a third thing to which the mystagogues have recently been applying the methods of a secret society. I mean manners. Men who sought to rebuke rudeness used to represent manners as reasonable and ordinary. Now they seek to represent them as private and peculiar. Instead of saying to a man who blocks up a street or the fireplace, "You ought to know better than that," the moderns say, "You, of course, don't know better than that." I have just been reading an amusing book by Lady Grove called The Social Fetich, which is a positive riot of this new specialism and mystification. It is due to Lady Grove to say that she has some of the freer and more honorable qualities of the old Whig aristocracy, as well as their wonderful worldliness and their strange faith in the passing fashion of our politics. For instance, she speaks of Jingo imperialism with a healthy English contempt, and she perceives stray and striking truths and records them justly, as, for instance, the great democracy of the southern and Catholic countries of Europe. But in her dealings with social formula here in England, she is, it must frankly be said, a common mystagogue. She does not, like a decent demagogue, wish to make people understand. She wishes to make them painfully conscious of not understanding. Her favorite method is to terrify people from doing things that are quite harmless by telling them that if they do, they are the kind of people who would do other things equally harmless. If you ask after somebody's mother, or whatever it is, you are the kind of person who would have a pillowcase, or would not have a pillowcase, I forget which it is, and so, I dare say, does she. If you assume the ordinary dignity of a decent citizen, and say that you don't see the harm of having a mother or a pillowcase, she would say that, of course, you wouldn't. This is what I call being a mystagogue. It is more vulgar than being a demagogue, because it is much easier. The primary point I meant to emphasize is that this sort of aristocracy is essentially a new sort. All the old despots were demagogues. At least, they were demagogues whenever they were really trying to please or impress the demos. If they pour out beer for their vassals, it was because both they and their vassals had a taste for beer. If, in some slightly different mood, they poured melted lead on their vassals, it was because both they and their vassals had a strong distaste for melted lead. But they did not make any mystery about either of the two substances. They did not say, "You don't like melted lead? No, of course you wouldn't. You are probably the kind of person who would prefer beer." It is no good asking you even to imagine the curious undercurrent of psychological pleasure felt by a refined person under the seeming shock of melted lead. Even tyrants, when they tried to be popular, tried to give the people pleasure. They did not try to overawe the people by giving them something which they ought to regard as pleasure. It was the same with the popular presentment of aristocracy. Aristocrats tried to impress humanity by the exhibition of qualities which humanity admires, such as courage, gaiety, or even mere splendor. The aristocracy might have more possession in these things, but the democracy had quite equal delight in them. It was much more sensible to offer yourself for admiration because you had drunk 3 bottles of port at a sitting, than to offer yourself for admiration, as Lady Grove does, because you think it right to say port wine, while other people think it right to say port. Whether Lady Grove's preference for port wine, I mean for the phrase port wine, is a piece of mere nonsense, I do not know, but at least it is a very good example of the futility of such tests in the matter even of mere breeding. Port wine may happen to be the phrase used in certain good families, but numberless aristocrats say port, and all barmaids say port wine. The whole thing is rather more trivial than collecting tram tickets, and I will not pursue Lady Grove's further distinctions. I pass over the interesting theory that I ought to say to Jones, even apparently if he is my dearest friend, "How is Mr. Jones?" instead of "How is your wife?" and I pass over an impassioned declamation about bedspreads, I think, which has failed to fire my blood. The truth of the matter is really quite simple. An aristocracy is a secret society, and this is especially so when, as in the modern world, it is practically a plutocracy. The one idea of a secret society is to change the password. Lady Grove falls naturally into a pure perversity because she feels subconsciously that the people of England can be more effectively kept at a distance by a perpetual torrent of new tests than by the persistence of a few old ones. She knows that in the educated middle class there is an idea that it is vulgar to say port wine. Therefore, she reverses the idea. She says that the man who would say port is a man who would say, "How is your wife?" She says it because she knows both these remarks to be quite obvious and reasonable. The only thing to be done or said in reply, I suppose, would be to apply the same principle of bold mystification on our own part. I do not see why I should not write a book called Etiquette in Fleet Street, and terrify everyone else out of that thoroughfare by mysterious allusions to the mistakes that they generally make. I might say, "This is the kind of man who would wear a green tie when he went into tobacconists," or, "You don't see anything wrong in drinking a Benedictine on Thursday?" No, of course you wouldn't. I might asseverate with passionate disgust and disdain, "The man who is capable of writing sonnets as well as triolets is capable of climbing an omnibus while holding an umbrella. It seems a simple method. If ever I should master it, perhaps I may govern England. The Eatanswill Gazette. The other day someone presented me with a paper called the Eatanswill Gazette. I need hardly say that I could not have been more startled if I had seen a coach coming down the road with old Mr. Tony Weller on the box. But indeed, the case is much more extraordinary than that would be. Old Mr. Weller was a good man, a specially and seriously good man, a proud father and a very patient husband, a sane moralist and a reliable ally. One could not be so very much surprised if somebody pretended to be Tony Weller. But the Eatanswill Gazette is definitely depicted in Pickwick as a dirty and unscrupulous rag, soaked with slander and nonsense. It was really interesting to find a modern paper proud to take its name. The case cannot be compared to anything so simple as a resurrection of one of the Pickwick characters. Yet a very good parallel could easily be found. It is almost exactly as if a firm of solicitors were to open their offices tomorrow under the name of Dodson and Fogg. It was at once apparent, of course, that the thing was a joke. But what was not apparent, what only grew upon the mind with gradual wonder and terror, was the fact that it had its serious side. The paper is published in the well-known town of Sudbury, in Suffolk, and it seems that there is a standing quarrel between Sudbury and the country town of Ipswich as to which was the town described by Dickens in his celebrated sketch of an election. Each town proclaims with passion that it was Eatanswill. If each town proclaimed with passion that it was not Eatanswill, I might be able to understand it. Eatanswill, according to Dickens, was a town alive with loathsome corruption, hypocritical in all its public utterances, and venial in all its votes. Yet two highly respectable towns compete for the honor of having been this particular cesspool, just as 10 cities fought to be the birthplace of Homer. They claim to be its original as keenly as if they were claiming to be the original of Moore's Utopia or Morris's Earthly Paradise. They grow seriously heated over the matter. The men of Ipswich say warmly, "It must have been our town, for Dickens says it was corrupt, and a more corrupt town than our town you couldn't have met in a month." The men of Sudbury reply with rising passion, "Permit us to tell you, gentlemen, that our town was quite as corrupt as your town any day of the week. Our town was a common nuisance, and we defy our enemies to question it." "Perhaps you will tell us," sneer the citizens of Ipswich, "that your politics were ever as thoroughly filthy as..." "As filthy as anything," answered the Sudbury men, undauntedly. "Nothing in politics could be filthier. Dickens must have noticed how disgusting we were." "And could he have failed to notice," the others reasoned indignantly, "how disgusting we were? You could smell us a mile off. You Sudbury fellows may think yourselves very fine, but let me tell you that, compared to our city, Sudbury was an honest place." And so the controversy goes on. It seems to me to be a new and odd kind of controversy. Naturally, an outsider feels inclined to ask why Eatanswill should be either one or the other. As a matter of fact, I fear Eatanswill was every town in the country. It is surely clear that when Dickens described the Eatanswill election, he did not mean it as a satire on Sudbury or a satire on Ipswich. He meant it as a satire on England. The Eatanswill election is not a joke against Eatanswill. It is a joke against elections. If the satire is merely local, it practically loses its point, just as the Circumlocution Office would lose its point if it were not supposed to be a true sketch of all government offices, just as the Lord Chancellor in Bleak House would lose his point if he were not supposed to be symbolic and representative of all Lord Chancellors. The whole moral meaning would vanish if we supposed that Oliver Twist had got by accident into an exceptionally bad workhouse, or that Mr. Dorrit was in the only debtor's prison that was not well managed. Dickens was making a game, not of places, but of methods. He poured all his powerful genius into trying to make the people ashamed of the methods, but he seems only to have succeeded in making people proud of the places. In any case, the controversy is conducted in a truly extraordinary way. No one seems to allow for the fact that, after all, Dickens was writing a novel, and a highly fantastic novel at that. Facts in support of Sudbury or Ipswich are quoted not only from the story itself, which is wild and wandering enough, but even from the yet wilder narratives which incidentally occur in the story, such as Sam Weller's description of how his father, on the way to Eatanswill, tipped all the voters into the canal. This may quite easily be, to begin with, an entertaining taradiddle of Sam's own invention, told, like many other, even more improbable stories, solely to amuse Mr. Pickwick. Yet the champions of these two towns positively asked each other to produce a canal, or to fail forever in their attempts to prove themselves the most corrupt town in England. As far as I remember, Sam's story of the canal ends with Mr. Pickwick eagerly asking whether everybody was rescued, and Sam solemnly replying that one old gentleman's hat was found, but that he was not sure whether his head was in it. If the canal is to be taken as realistic, why not the hat and the head? If these critics ever find a canal, I recommend them to drag it for the body of the old gentleman. Both sides refuse to allow for the fact that the characters in the story are comic characters. For instance, Mr. Percy Fitzgerald, the eminent student of Dickens, writes to the Eatanswill Gazette to say that Sudbury, a small town, could not have been Eatanswill because one of the candidates speaks of its great manufactures. But obviously one of the candidates would have spoken of its great manufactures if it had nothing but a row of apple stalls. One of the candidates might have said that the commerce of Eatanswill eclipsed Carthage and covered every sea. It would have been quite in the style of Dickens. But when the champion of Sudbury answers him, he does not point out this plain mistake. He answers by making another mistake exactly of the same kind. He says that Eatanswill was not a busy, important place, and his odd reason is that Mrs. Pott says she was dull there. But obviously Mrs. Pott would have said she was dull anywhere. She was setting her cap at Mr. Winkle. Moreover, it was the whole point of her character in any case. Mrs. Pott was that kind of woman. If she had been in Ipswich, she would have said that she ought to be in London. If she was in London, she would have said she ought to be in Paris. The first disputant proves Eatanswill grand because a servile candidate calls it grand. The second proves it dull because a discontented woman calls it dull. The great part of the controversy seems to be conducted in the spirit of highly irrelevant realism. Sudbury cannot be Eatanswill because there was a fancy dress shop at Eatanswill, and there is no record of a fancy dress shop at Sudbury. Sudbury must be Eatanswill because there were heavy roads outside Eatanswill, and there are heavy roads outside Sudbury. Ipswich cannot be Eatanswill because Mrs. Leo Hunter's country seat would not be near a big town. Ipswich must be Eatanswill because Mrs. Leo Hunter's country seat would be near a large town. Really, Dickens ought to have been allowed to take liberties with such things as these, even if he had been mentioning the place by name. If I were writing a story about the town of Limerick, I should take the liberty of introducing a bun shop without taking a journey to Limerick to see whether there was a bun shop there. If I wrote a romance about Torquay, I should hold myself free to introduce a house with a green door without having studied a list of all the colored doors in the town. But if, in order to make it particularly obvious that I had not meant the town for a photograph, either of Torquay or Limerick, I had gone out of my way to give the place a wild, fictitious name of my own, I think that in that case I should be justified in tearing my hair with rage if the people of Limerick or Torquay began to argue about bun shops and green doors. No reasonable man would expect Dickens to be so literal as all that, even about Bath or Bury St. Edmunds, which do exist. Far less need he be literal about Eatanswill, which did not exist. I must confess, however, that I incline to the Sudbury side of the argument. This does not only arise from the sympathy which all healthy people have for small places as against big ones. It arises from some really good qualities in this particular Sudbury publication. First of all, the champions of Sudbury seem to be more open to the sensible and humorous view of the book than the champions of Ipswich, at least those that appear in this discussion. Even the Sudbury champion, bent on finding realistic clothes, rebels to his eternal honor when Mr. Percy Fitzgerald tries to show that Bob Sawyer's famous statement that he was neither buff nor blue, but a sort of plaid, must have been copied from some silly man at Ipswich who said that his politics were half and half. Anybody might have made either of the two jokes, but it was the whole glory and meaning of Dickens that he confined himself to making jokes that anybody might have made a little better than anybody would have made them. End of section 10.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. All Things Considered by G. K. Chesterton. Section 11. Fairy Tales. Some solemn and superficial people, for nearly all very superficial people are solemn, have declared that the fairy tales are immoral. They base this upon some accidental circumstances or regrettable incidents in the war between giants and boys, some cases in which the latter indulged in unsympathetic deceptions or even in practical jokes. The objection, however, is not only false, but very much the reverse of the facts. The fairy tales are at root not only moral in the sense of being innocent, but moral in the sense of being didactic, moral in the sense of being moralizing. It is all very well to talk of the freedom of fairyland, but there was precious little freedom in fairyland by the best official counts. Mr. W. B. Yeats and other sensitive modern souls, feeling that modern life is about as black a slavery as ever oppressed mankind, they are right enough there, have specially described Elfland as a place of utter ease and abandonment, a place where the soul can turn every way at will like the wind. Science denounces the idea of a capricious God, but Mr. Yeats' school suggests that in the world everyone is a capricious God. Mr. Yeats himself has said 100 times that sad and splendid literary style which makes him the first of all poets now writing in English. I will not say of all English poets, for Irishmen are familiar with the practice of physical assault. He has, I say, called up 100 times the picture of the terrible freedom of the fairies who typify the ultimate anarchy of art. Where nobody grows old or weary or wise, where nobody grows old or godly or grave. But, after all, it is a shocking thing to say. I doubt whether Mr. Yeats really knows the real philosophy of the fairies. He's not simple enough, he is not stupid enough. Though I say it, who should not, in good-sounding human stupidity, I would knock Mr. Yeats out any day. The fairies like me better than Mr. Yeats. They can take me in more, and I have my doubts whether this feeling of the free wild spirits on the crest of hill or wave is really the central and simple spirit of folklore. I think the poets have made a mistake, because the world of the fairy tales is a brighter and more varied world than ours. They have fancied it less moral. Really, it is brighter and more varied because it is more moral. Suppose a man could be born in a modern prison. It's impossible, of course, because nothing human can happen in a modern prison, though it could sometimes in an ancient dungeon. A modern prison is always inhuman, even when it is not inhumane. But suppose a man were born in a modern prison and grew accustomed to the deadly silence and the disgusting indifference, and suppose he were then suddenly turned loose upon life and laughter of Fleet Street. He would, of course, think that the literary men in Fleet Street were a free and happy race. Yet how sadly, how ironically, is this the reverse of the case. And so, again, these toiling serfs in Fleet Street, when they catch a glimpse of the fairies, think the fairies are utterly free. But fairies are like journalists in this and many other respects. Fairies and journalists have an apparent gaiety and a delusive beauty. Fairies and journalists seem to be lovely and lawless. They seem to be, both of them, too exquisite to descend to the ugliness of everyday duty. But it is an illusion created by the sudden sweetness of their presence. Journalists live under law, and so, in fact, does Fairyland. If you really read the fairy tales, you will observe that one idea runs from one end of them to the other, the idea that peace and happiness can only exist on some condition. This idea, which is the core of ethics, is the core of the nursery tales. The whole happiness of Fairyland hangs upon a thread, upon one thread. Cinderella may have a dress woven on supernatural looms and blazing with unearthly brilliance, but she must be back when the clock strikes 12. The king may invite fairies to the christening, but he must invite all the fairies, or frightful results will follow. Bluebeard's wife may open all the doors but one. A promise is broken to a cat, and the whole world goes wrong. A promise is broken to a yellow dwarf, and the whole world goes wrong. A girl may be the bride of the god of love himself, if she never tries to see him. She sees him, and he vanishes away. A girl is given a box on conditions that she does not open it. She opens it, and all the evils of this world rush out at her. A man and woman are put in a garden on condition that they do not eat one fruit. They eat it, and lose their joy in all the fruits of the earth. This great idea, then, is the backbone of all folklore, the idea that all happiness hangs on one thin veto. All positive joy depends on one negative. Now, it is obvious that there are many philosophical and religious ideas akin to or symbolized by this, but it is not with them I wish to deal here. It is surely obvious that all ethics ought to be taught to this fairy tale tune, that if one does the thing forbidden, one imperils all the things provided. A man who breaks his promise to his wife ought to be reminded that, even if she is a cat, the case of the fairy cat shows that such conduct may be incautious. A burglar just about to open someone else's safe should be playfully reminded that he is in the perilous posture of the beautiful Pandora. He is about to lift the forbidden lid and loosen evils unknown. The boy eating someone's apples in someone's apple tree should be a reminder that he has come to a mystical moment of his life, when one apple may rob him of all others. This is the profound morality of fairy tales, which, so far from being lawless, go to the root of all law. Instead of finding, like common books of ethics, a rationalistic basis for each commandment, they find the great mystical basis for all commandments. We are in this fairyland on sufferance. It is not for us to quarrel with the conditions under which we enjoy this wild vision of the world. The vetoes are indeed extraordinary, but then so are the concessions. The idea of property, the idea of someone else's apples, is a rum idea. But then the idea of there being any apples is a rum idea. It is strange and weird that I cannot with safety drink 10 bottles of champagne, but then the champagne itself is strange and weird, if you come to that. If I have drunk of the fairies' drink, it is but just that I should drink of the fairies' rules. We may not see the direct logical connection between 3 beautiful silver spoons and a large ugly policeman, but then who in fairy tales ever could see the direct logical connection between 3 bears and a giant, or between a rose and a roaring beast? Not only can these fairy tales be enjoyed because they are moral, but morality can be enjoyed because it puts us in fairyland, in a world at once of wonder and of war. Tom Jones and Morality. The 200th anniversary of Henry Fielding is very justly celebrated, even if, as far as can be discovered, it is only celebrated by the newspapers. It would be too much to expect that any such merely chronological incident should induce the people who write about Fielding to read him. This kind of neglect is only another name for glory. A great classic means a man whom one can praise without having read. This is not in itself wholly unjust. It merely implies a certain respect for the realization and fixed conclusions of the mass of mankind. I have never read Pindar. I mean, I have never read the Greek Pindar. Peter Pindar I've read all right. But the mere fact that I have not read Pindar, I think, ought not to prevent me, and certainly would not prevent me, from talking of the masterpieces of Pindar, or of great poets like Pindar or Aeschylus. The very learned men are angular, unenlightened on this as on many other subjects, and the position they take up is really quite unreasonable. If any ordinary journalist or man of general reading alludes to Villon or Homer, they consider it a quite triumphant sneer to say to the man, "You cannot read medieval French, or you cannot read Homeric Greek." But it is not a triumphant sneer, or indeed a sneer at all. A man has got as much right to employ in his speech the established and traditional facts of human history as he has to employ any other piece of common human information. And it is as reasonable for a man who knows no French to assume that Villon was a good poet as it would be for a man who has no ear for music to assume that Beethoven was a good musician. Because he himself has no ear for music, that is no reason why he should assume that the human race has no ear for music. Because I am ignorant, as I am, it does not follow that I ought to assume that I am deceived. The man who would not praise Pindar unless he had read him would be a low, distrustful fellow, the worst kind of skeptic who doubts not only God, but man. He would be like a man who could not call Mount Everest high unless he had climbed it. He would be like a man who would not admit that the North Pole was cold until he had been there. But I think there is a limit, and a highly legitimate limit, to this process. I think a man may praise Pindar without knowing the top of a Greek letter from the bottom. But I think that if a man is going to abuse Pindar, if he's going to denounce, refute, and utterly expose Pindar, if he's going to show Pindar up as the utter ignoramus and outrageous imposture that he is, then I think it will be just as well, perhaps, I think at any rate it would do no harm, if he did know a little Greek and even had read a little Pindar. And I think the same situation would be involved if the critic were concerned to point out that Pindar was scandalously immoral, pestilently cynical, or low and beastly in his views of life. When people brought such attacks against the morality of Pindar, I should regret that they could not read Greek, and when they bring such attacks against the morality of Fielding, I regret very much that they cannot read English. There seems to be an extraordinary idea abroad that Fielding was in some way an immoral or offensive writer. I have been astounded by the number of the leading articles, literary articles, and other articles written about him just now, in which there is a curious tone of apologizing for the man. One critic says that, after all, he couldn't help it, because he lived in the 18th century. Another says that we must allow for the change of manners and ideas. Another says that he was not altogether without generous and humane feelings. Another suggests that he clung feebly, after all, to a few of the less important virtues. What on earth does all this mean? Fielding described Tom Jones as going on in a certain way in which, most unfortunately, a very large number of young men do go on. It's unnecessary to say that Henry Fielding knew that it was an unfortunate way of going on. Even Tom Jones knew that. He said in so many words that it was a very unfortunate way of going on. He said, one may almost say, that it had ruined his life. The passage is there for the benefit of anyone who may take the trouble to read the book. There is ample evidence, though even this is of a mystical and indirect kind, there is ample evidence that Fielding probably thought that it was better to be Tom Jones than to be an utter coward and sneak. There is simply not one rag or thread or speck of evidence to show that Fielding thought it was better to be Tom Jones than to be a good man. All that he is concerned with is the description of a definite and very real type of young man, the young man whose passions and whose selfish necessities sometimes seem to be stronger than anything else in him. The practical morality of Tom Jones is bad enough, though not so bad spiritually speaking, as the practical morality of Arthur Pendennis, or the practical morality of Pip, and certainly nothing like so bad as the profound practical immorality of Daniel Deronda. The practical morality of Tom Jones is bad, but I cannot see any proof that his theoretical morality was particularly bad. There is no need to tell the majority of modern young men even to live up to the theoretical ethics of Henry Fielding. They would suddenly spring into the stature of archangels if they lived up to the theoretic ethics of poor Tom Jones. Tom Jones is still alive, with all his good and all his evil. He is walking about the streets. We meet him every day. We meet with him, we drink with him, we smoke with him, we talk about him. The only difference is that we have no longer the intellectual courage to write about him. We split up the supreme and central human being, Tom Jones, into a number of separate aspects. We let Mr. J.M. Barrie write about him in his good moments and make him out better than he is. We let Zola write about him in his bad moments and make him out much worse than he is. We let Maeterlinck celebrate those moments of spiritual panic which he knows to be cowardly. We let Mr. Rudyard Kipling celebrate those moments of brutality which he knows to be far more cowardly. We let obscene writers write about the obscenities of this ordinary man. We let Puritan writers write about the purities of this ordinary man. We look through one peephole that makes men out as devils, and we call it the new art. We look through another peephole that makes men out as angels, and we call it the new theology. But if we pull down some dusty old books from the bookshelf, if we turn over some old mildewed leaves, and if in that obscurity and decay we find some faint traces of a tale about a complete man, such a man as is walking on the pavement outside, we suddenly pull a long face, and we call it the coarse morals of a bygone age. The truth is that all these things mark a certain change in the general view of morals, not, I think, a change for the better. We have grown to associate morality in a book with a kind of optimism and prettiness. According to us, a moral book is a book about moral people. But the old idea was almost exactly the opposite. A moral book was a book about immoral people. A moral book was full of pictures like Hogarth's Gin Lane or Stages of Cruelty. Or it recorded, like the popular broadsheet, God's dreadful judgment against some blasphemer or murderer. There is a philosophical reason for this change. The homeless skepticism of our time has reached a subconscious feeling that morality is somehow merely a matter of human taste, an accident of psychology. And if goodness only exists in certain human minds, a man wishing to praise goodness will naturally exaggerate the amount of it that there is in human minds, or the number of human minds in which it is supreme. Every confession that man is vicious is a confession that virtue is visionary. Every book which admits that evil is real is felt in some vague way to be admitting that good is unreal. The modern instinct is that if the heart of the man is evil, there is nothing that remains good. But the older feeling was that if the heart of a man was ever so evil, there was something that remained good. Goodness remained good. An actual avenging virtue existed outside the human race. To that men rose, or from that men fell away. Therefore, of course, this law itself was as much demonstrated in the breach as in the observance. If Tom Jones violated morality, so much the worse for Tom Jones. Fielding did not feel, as a melancholy modern would have done, that every sin of Tom Jones was in some way breaking the spell, or we may even say destroying the fiction of morality. Men spoke of the sinner breaking the law, but it was rather the law that broke him. And what modern people call the foulness and freedom of Fielding is generally the severity and moral stringency of Fielding. He would not have thought that he was serving morality at all if he had written a book all about nice people. Fielding would have considered Mr. Ian McLaren extremely immoral, and there's something to be said for that view. Telling the truth about the terrible struggle of the human soul is surely a very elementary part of the ethics of honesty. If the characters are not wicked, the book is. This older and firmer conception of right as existing outside human weakness and without reference to human error can be felt in the very lightest and loosest of the works of old English literature. It is commonly unmeaning enough to call Shakespeare a great moralist, but in this particular way Shakespeare is a very typical moralist. Whenever he alludes to right and wrong, it is always with this old implication. Right is right, even if nobody does it. Wrong is wrong, even if everybody is wrong about it. The Maid of Orleans. A considerable time ago, at a far too early age, in fact, I read Voltaire's La Pucelle, a savage sarcasm on the traditional purity of Joan of Arc, very dirty and very funny. I had not thought of it again for years, but it came back in my mind this morning because I began to turn over the leaves of the new Jeanne d'Arc by the great and graceful writer Anatole France. It is written in a tone of tender sympathy and a sort of sad reverence. It never loses touch with a noble tact and courtesy like that of a gentleman escorting a peasant girl through the modern crowd. It is invariably respectful to Joan, and even respectful to her religion. And being myself a furious admirer of Joan the Maid, I have reflectively compared the two methods, and I have come to the conclusion that I prefer Voltaire's. When a man of Voltaire's school has to explode a saint or a great religious hero, he says that such a person is a common human fool or a common human fraud. But when a man like Anatole France has to explode a saint, he explains the saint as somebody belonging to his particular fussy little literary set. Voltaire read human nature into Joan of Arc, though it was only the brutal part of human nature. At least it was not specially Voltaire's nature, but Monsieur France reads Monsieur France's nature into Joan of Arc. All the cold kindness, all the homeless sentimental sin of the modern literary man. There is one book that it recalled to me with a startling vividness, though I have not seen the matter mentioned anywhere, Renan's Vie de Jesus. It has just the same general intention, that if you do not attack Christianity, you can at least patronize it. My own instinct apart from my opinions would be quite the other way. If I disbelieved in Christianity, I should be the loudest blasphemer in Hyde Park. Nothing ought to be too big for a brave man to attack, but there are some things too big for a man to patronize. And I must say that the historical method seems to me excessively unreasonable. I have no knowledge of history, but I have as much knowledge of reason as Anatole France. And if anything is irrational, it seems to me that the Renan France way of dealing with miraculous stories is irrational. The Renan France method is simply this. You explain supernatural stories that have some foundation simply by inventing natural stories that have no foundation. Suppose that you are confronted with the statement that Jack climbed up the beanstalk into the sky. It is perfectly philosophical to reply that you do not think that he did. It is, in my opinion, even more philosophical to reply that he may very probably have done so. But the Renan France method is to write like this. When we consider Jack's curious and even perilous heredity, which no doubt was derived from a female greengrocer and a profligate priest, we can easily understand how the ideas of heaven and a beanstalk came to be combined in his mind. Moreover, there is little doubt that he must have met some wandering conjurer from India who told him about the tricks of the mango plant and how it is sent up to the sky. We can imagine these two friends, the old man and the young, wandering in the woods together at evening, looking at the red and level clouds, as on that night when the old man pointed to a small beanstalk and told his too imaginative companion that this also might be made to scale the heavens. And then, when we remember the quite exceptional psychology of Jack, when we remember how there was in him a union of the prosaic, the love of plain vegetables, with an almost irrelevant eagerness for the unattainable, for invisibility and the void, we shall no longer wonder that it was to him especially that was sent this sweet, though merely symbolic, dream of the tree uniting earth and heaven. That is the way that Renan and France write, only they do it better. But really, a rationalist like myself becomes a little impatient and feels inclined to say, "But hang it all, what do you know about the heredity of Jack or the psychology of Jack? You know nothing about Jack at all, except that some people say that he climbed up a beanstalk. Nobody would ever have thought of mentioning him if he hadn't. You must interpret him in terms of the beanstalk religion. You cannot merely interpret religion in terms of him. We have the materials of this story, and we can believe in them or not, but we have not got the materials to make another story." It is no exaggeration to say that this is the manner of Monsieur Anatole France in dealing with Joan of Arc. Because her miracle is incredible to his somewhat old-fashioned materialism, he does not therefore dismiss it and her to fairyland with Jack and the beanstalk. He tries to invent a real story for which he can find no real evidence. He produces a scientific explanation which is quite destitute of any scientific proof. It is as if I, being entirely ignorant of botany and chemistry, said that the beanstalk grew to the sky because nitrogen and argon got into the subsidiary ducts of the corolla. To take the most obvious example, the principal character in Monsieur France's story is a person who never existed at all. Joan's wisdom and energy, it seems, came from a certain priest, of whom there is not the tiniest trace in all the multitudinous records of her life. The only foundation I can find for this fancy is the highly undemocratic idea that a peasant girl could not possibly have any ideas of her own. It is very hard for a free thinker to remain democratic. The writer seems altogether to forget what is meant by the moral atmosphere of a community. To say that Joan must have learnt her vision of a virgin overthrowing evil from a priest is like saying that some modern girl in London, pitying the poor, must have learnt it from a Labour member. She would learn it where the Labour member learnt it, in the whole state of our society. But that is the modern method, the method of the reverent sceptic. When you find a life entirely incredible and incomprehensible from the outside, you pretend that you understand the inside. As Renan the rationalist could not make any sense out of Christ's most public acts, he proceeded to make an ingenious system out of his private thoughts. As Anatole France, on his own intellectual principle, cannot believe in what Joan of Arc did, he professed to be her dearest friend and to know exactly what she meant. I cannot feel it to be a very rational manner of writing history, and sooner or later we shall have to find some more solid way of dealing with those spiritual phenomena with which all of history is as closely spotted and spangled as the sky is with stars. Joan of Arc is a wild and wonderful thing enough, but she is much saner than most of her critics and biographers. We shall not recover the common sense of Joan till we have recovered her mysticism. Our wars fail because they begin with something sensible and obvious, such as getting to Pretoria by Christmas. But her war succeeded because it began with something wild and perfect, the saints delivering France. She put her idealism in the right place and her realism also in the right place. We moderns get both displaced. She put her dreams and her sentiment into her aims where they ought to be. She put her practicality into her practice. In modern imperial wars the case is reversed. Our dreams, our aims are always, we insist, quite practical. It is our practice that is dreamy. It is not for us to explain this flaming figure in terms of our tired and querulous culture. Rather, we must try to explain ourselves by the blaze of such fixed stars. Those who called her a witch, hot from hell, were much more sensible than those who depicted her as a silly, sentimental maiden prompted by her parish priest. If I have to choose between the two schools of her scattered enemies, I should take my place with those subtle clerks who thought her divine mission devilish, rather than with those rustic aunts and uncles who thought it impossible. End of section 11.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. All Things Considered by G. K. Chesterton. Section 12. A Dead Poet. With Francis Thompson, we lose the greatest poetic energy since Browning. His energy was of somewhat the same kind. Browning was intellectually intricate because he was morally simple. He was too simple to explain himself. He was too humble to suppose that other people needed any explanation. But his real energy, and the real energy of Francis Thompson, was best expressed in the fact that both poets were at once fond of immensity and also fond of detail. Any common imperialist can have large ideas so long as he is not called upon to have small ideas also. Any common scientific philosopher can have small ideas so long as he is not called upon to have large ideas as well. But the great poets use the telescope and also the microscope. Great poets are obscure for two opposite reasons. Now, because they are talking about something too large for anyone to understand, and now again, because they are talking about something too small for anyone to see. Francis Thompson possessed both these infinities. He escaped by being too small, as the microbe escapes, or he escaped by being too large, as the universe escapes. Anyone who knows Francis Thompson's poetry knows quite well the truth to which I refer. For the benefit of any person who does not know it, I may mention two cases taken from memory. I have not the book by me, so I can only render the poetical passages in a clumsy paraphrase. But there was one poem of which the image was so vast that it was literally difficult for a time to take it in. He was describing the evening earth with its mist and fume and fragrance, and represented the whole as rolling upwards like a smoke. Then suddenly he called the whole ball of the earth a thurible, and said that some gigantic spirit swung it slowly before God. That is the case of the image too large for comprehension. Another instance sticks in my mind of the image which is too small. In one of his poems he says that abyss between the known and the unknown is bridged by pontifical death. There are about 10 historical and theological puns in that one word. That a priest means a pontiff, that a pontiff means a bridge maker, that death is certainly a bridge, that death may turn out after all to be a reconciling priest, that at least priests and bridges both attest to the fact that one thing can get separated from another thing. These ideas and 20 more are all actually concentrated in the word pontifical. In Francis Thompson's poetry, as in the poetry of the universe, you can work infinitely out and out, but yet infinitely in and in. These two infinities are the mark of greatness, and he was a great poet. Beneath the tide of praise, which was obviously due to the dead poet, there is an evident undercurrent of discussion about him. Some charges of moral weakness were at least important enough to be authoritatively contradicted in The Nation. And in connection with this and other things, there has been a continuous stir of comment upon his attraction to and gradual absorption in Catholic theological ideas. This question is so important that I think it ought to be considered and understood even at the present time. It is, of course, true that Francis Thompson devoted himself more and more to poems, not only purely Catholic, but, one may say, purely ecclesiastical. And it is moreover true that, if things go on as they are going on at present, more and more good poets will do the same. Poets will tend toward Christian orthodoxy for a perfectly plain reason, because it is about the simplest and freest thing now left in the world. On this point it is very necessary to be clear. When people impute special vices to the Christian Church, they seem entirely to forget that the world, which is the only other thing there is, has these vices much more. The Church has been cruel, but the world has been much more cruel. The Church has plotted, but the world has plotted much more. The Church has been superstitious, but it has never been so superstitious as the world is, when left to itself. Now, poets in our epoch will tend towards ecclesiastical religion strictly because it is just a little more free than anything else. Take, for instance, the case of symbol and ritualism. All reasonable men believe in symbol, but some reasonable men do not believe in ritualism, by which they mean, I imagine, a symbolism too complex, elaborate, and mechanical. But whenever they talk of ritualism, they always seem to mean the ritualism of the Church. Why should they not mean the ritual of the world? It is much more ritualistic. The ritual of the army, the ritual of the navy, the ritual of the law courts, the ritual of Parliament are much more ritualistic. The ritual of a dinner party is much more ritualistic. Priests may put gold and great jewels on the chalice, but at least there is only one chalice to put them on. When you go to a dinner party, they put in front of you five different chalices of five weird and heraldic shapes to symbolize five different kinds of wine, an insane extension of ritual from which Mr. Percy Dearmer would fly shrieking. A bishop wears a mitre, but he is not thought more or less of a bishop according to whether you can see the very latest curves in his mitre. But a swell is thought more or less of a swell according to whether you can see the very latest curves in his hat. There is more fuss about symbols in the world than in the Church. And yet, strangely enough, though men fuss more about the worldly symbols, they mean less by them. It is the mark of religious forms that they declare something unknown. But it is the mark of worldly forms that they declare something which is known, and which is known to be untrue. When the Pope, in an encyclical, calls himself your father, it is a matter of faith or of doubt. But when the Duke of Devonshire, in a letter, calls himself yours obediently, you know that he means the opposite of what he says. Religious forms are, at the worst, fables. They might be true. Secular forms are falsehoods. They are not true. Take a more topical case. The German emperor has more uniforms than the Pope. But moreover, the Pope's vestments all imply a claim to be something purely mystical and doubtful. Many of the German emperor's uniforms imply a claim to be something which he certainly is not, and which it would be highly disgusting if he were. The Pope may or may not be the Vicar of Christ, but the Kaiser certainly is not an English colonel. If the thing were reality, it would be treason. If it is mere ritual, it is by far the most unreal ritual on earth. Now poetical people like Francis Thompson will, as things stand, tend away from secular society and towards religion for the reason above described, that there are crowds of symbols in both, but that those of religion are simpler and mean more. To take an evident type, the cross is more poetical than the Union Jack, because it is simpler. The more simple an idea is, the more it is fertile in variations. Francis Thompson could have written any number of good poems on the cross, because it is a primary symbol. The number of poems which Mr. Rudyard Kipling could write on the Union Jack is fortunately limited, because the Union Jack is too complex to produce luxuriance. The same principle applies to any possible number of cases. A poet like Francis Thompson could deduce perpetually rich and branching meanings out of two plain facts like bread and wine. With bread and wine he can expand everything to everywhere. But with a French menu he cannot expand anything except perhaps himself. Complicated ideas do not produce any more ideas. Mongrels do not breed. Religious ritual attracts because there is some sense in it. Religious imagery, so far from being subtle, is the only simple thing left for poets. So far from being merely superhuman, it is the only human thing left for human beings. Christmas. There is no more dangerous or disgusting habit than that of celebrating Christmas before it comes, as I am doing in this article. It is the very essence of a festival that it breaks upon one brilliantly and abruptly, that at one moment the great day is not, and the next moment the great day is. Up to a certain specific instant you are feeling ordinary and sad, for it is only Wednesday. At the next moment your heart leaps up and your soul and body dance together like lovers, for in one burst and blaze it has become Thursday. I am assuming, of course, that you are a worshipper of Thor, and that you celebrate his day once a week, possibly with human sacrifice. If, on the other hand, you are a modern Christian Englishman, you hail, of course, with the same explosion of gaiety, the appearance of the English Sunday. But I say that, whatever the day is that is to you festive or symbolic, it is essential that there should be a quite clear black line between it and the time going before, and all the old wholesome customs in connection with Christmas were to the effect that one should not touch or see or know or speak of something before the actual coming of Christmas Day. Thus, for instance, children were never given their presents till the actual coming of the appointed hour. The presents were kept tied up in brown paper parcels, out of which an arm of a doll or the leg of a donkey sometimes accidentally stuck. I wish this principle were adopted in respect of modern Christmas ceremonies and publications. Especially it ought to be observed in connection with what are called the Christmas numbers of magazines. The editors of the magazines bring out their Christmas numbers so long before the time that the reader is more likely to be still lamenting for the turkey of last year than to have seriously settled down to a solid anticipation of the turkey which is to come. Christmas numbers of magazines ought to be tied up in brown paper and kept for Christmas Day. On consideration, I should favor the editors being tied up in brown paper. Whether the leg or arm of an editor should ever be allowed to protrude, I leave to the individual choice. Of course, all this secrecy about Christmas is merely sentimental and ceremonial. If you do not like what is sentimental and ceremonial, do not celebrate Christmas at all. You will not be punished if you don't. Also, since we are no longer ruled by those sturdy Puritans who won for us civil and religious liberty, you will not even be punished if you do. But I cannot understand why anyone should bother about a ceremonial except ceremonially. If a thing only exists in order to be graceful, do it gracefully, or do not do it. If a thing only exists as something professing to be solemn, do it solemnly, or do not do it. There is no sense in doing it slouchingly, nor is there even any liberty. I can understand the man who takes off his hat to a lady because it is the customary symbol. I can understand him, I say. In fact, I know him quite intimately. I can also understand the man who refuses to take off his hat to a lady, like the old Quakers, because he thinks that a symbol is superstition. But what point would there be in so performing an arbitrary form of respect that it was not a form of respect? We respect the gentleman who takes off his hat to the lady. We respect the fanatic who will not take off his hat to the lady. But what should we think of the man who kept his hands in his pockets and asked the lady to take his hat off for him because he felt tired? This is combining insolence and superstition, and the modern world is full of the strange combination. There is no mark of the immense weak-mindedness of modernity that is more striking than this general disposition to keep up old forms, but to keep them up informally and feebly. Why take something which was only meant to be respectful and preserve it disrespectfully? Why take something which you could easily abolish as superstition and carefully perpetuate it as a bore? There have been many instances of this half-witted compromise. Was it not true, for instance, that the other day that some mad American was trying to buy Glastonbury Abbey and transfer it stone by stone to America? Such things are not only illogical, but idiotic. There's no particular reason why a pushing American financier should pay respect to Glastonbury Abbey at all. But if he is to pay respect to Glastonbury Abbey, he must pay respect to Glastonbury. If it is a matter of sentiment, why should he spoil the scene? If it is not a matter of sentiment, why should he ever have visited the scene? To call this kind of thing vandalism is a very inadequate and unfair description. The Vandals were very sensible people. They did not believe in a religion, and so they insulted it. They did not see any use for certain buildings, and so they knocked them down. But they were not such fools as to encumber their march with the fragments of the edifice they had themselves spoilt. They were at least superior to the modern American mode of reasoning. They did not desecrate the stones, because they held them sacred. Another instance of the same illogicality I observed the other day at some kind of at-home. I saw what appeared to be a human being dressed in a black evening coat, black dress waistcoat, and black dress trousers, but with a shirt front made of Jaeger wool. What can be the sense of this sort of thing? If a man thinks hygiene is more important than convention, a selfish and heathen view, for the beasts that perish are more hygienic than man, and man is only above them because he is more conventional. If I say a man thinks that hygiene is more important than convention, what on earth is there to oblige him to wear a shirt front at all, but to take a costume of which the only conceivable cause or advantage is that it is a sort of uniform, and then not wear it in the uniform way? This is to be neither a bohemian nor a gentleman. It is a foolish affectation, I think, in an English officer of the Life Guards never to wear his uniform if he can help it. But it would be more foolish still if he showed himself about town in a scarlet coat and a Jaeger breastplate. It is the custom nowadays to have ritual commissions and ritual reports, to make rather unmeaning compromises in the ceremonial of the Church of England. So perhaps we shall have an ecclesiastical compromise by which all the bishops shall wear Jaeger copes and Jaeger mitres. Similarly, the king might insist on having a Jaeger crown. But I do not think he will, for he understands the logic of the matter better than that. The modern monarch, like a reasonable fellow, wears his crown as seldom as he can, but if he does it at all, then the only point of a crown is that it is a crown. So let me assure the unknown gentleman in the woolen vesture that the only point of a white shirt front is that it is a white shirt front. Stiffness may be its impossible defect, but it is certainly its only possible merit. Let us be consistent, therefore, about Christmas, and either keep customs or not keep them. If you do not like the sentiment and symbolism, you do not like Christmas. Go away and celebrate something else. I should suggest the birthday of Mr. McCabe. No doubt you could have a sort of scientific Christmas with a hygienic pudding and highly instructive presents stuffed into a Jaeger stocking. Go and have it, then. If you like those things, doubtless you are a good sort of fellow and your intentions are excellent. I have no doubt that you are really interested in humanity, but I cannot think that humanity will ever be much interested in you. Humanity is unhygienic from its very nature and beginning. It is so much an exception in nature that the law of nature really means nothing to it. Now, Christmas is attacked also on the humanitarian grounds. Ouida calls it a feast of slaughter and gluttony. Mr. Shaw suggested that it was invented by poulterers. That should be considered before it becomes more considerable. I do not know whether an animal killed at Christmas has had a better or worse time than it would have had if there had been no Christmas or no Christmas dinners. But I do know that the fighting and suffering brotherhood to which I belong and owe everything, mankind, would have had a much worse time if there were no such thing as Christmas or Christmas dinners. Whether the turkey which Scrooge gave to Bob Cratchit had experienced a lovelier or more melancholy career than that of less attractive turkeys is a subject upon which I cannot even conjecture. But that Scrooge was better for giving the turkey and Cratchit happier for getting it, I know as two facts, as I know that I have 2 feet. What life and death may be to a turkey is not my business, but the soul of Scrooge and the body of Cratchit are my business. Nothing shall induce me to darken human homes, to destroy human festivities, to insult human gifts and human benefactions, for the sake of some hypothetical knowledge which nature curtained from our eyes. We men and women are all in the same boat, upon a stormy sea. We owe to each other a terrible and tragic loyalty. If we catch sharks for food, let them be killed most mercifully. Let anyone who likes love the sharks and pet the sharks and tie ribbons round their necks and give them sugar and teach them to dance. But if once a man suggests that a shark is to be valued against a sailor, or that the poor shark might be permitted to bite off a leg occasionally, then I would court-martial the man. He is a traitor to the ship. And while I take this view of humanitarianism of the anti-Christmas kind, it is cogent to say that I am a strong anti-vivisectionist. That is, if there is any vivisection, I am against it. I am against the cutting up of conscious dogs for the same reason that I am in favor of the eating of dead turkeys. The connection may not be too obvious, but that is because of the strange, unhealthy condition of modern thought. I am against cruel vivisection as I am against cruel anti-Christmas asceticism, because they both involve the upsetting of existing fellowships and the shocking of normal good feelings for the sake of something that is intellectual, fanciful, and remote. It is not a human thing. It is not a humane thing when you see a poor woman staring hungrily at a bloater to think not of the obvious feelings of the woman, but of the unimaginable feelings of the deceased bloater. Similarly, it is not human, it is not humane, when you look at a dog to think about what theoretic discoveries you might possibly make if you were allowed to bore a hole in his head. Both the humanitarian's fancy about the feelings concealed inside the bloater and the vivisectionist's fancy about the knowledge concealed inside the dog are unhealthy fancies, because they upset human sanity that is certain for the sake of something that is of necessity uncertain. The vivisectionist, for the sake of doing something that may or may not be useful, does something that certainly is horrible. The anti-Christmas humanitarian, in seeking to have a sympathy with a turkey, which no man can have with a turkey, loses the sympathy he has already with the happiness of millions of the poor. It is not uncommon nowadays for the insane extremes in reality to meet. Thus I have always felt that brutal imperialism and Tolstoyan non-resistance were not only not opposite, but were the same thing. They are the same contemptible thought that conquest cannot be resisted, looked at from the two standpoints of the conqueror and the conquered. Thus again, teetotalitarianism and the really degraded gin-selling and dram-drinking have exactly the same moral philosophy. They are both based on the idea that fermented liquor is not a drink, but a drug. But I am especially certain that the extreme of vegetarian humanity is, as I have said, akin to the extreme of scientific cruelty. They both permit a dubious speculation to interfere with their ordinary charity. The sound moral rule in such matters as vivisection always presents itself to me in this way. There is no ethical necessity more essential and vital than this, that casuistical exceptions, though admitted, should be admitted as exceptions. And it follows from this, I think, that though we may do a horrid thing in a horrid situation, we must be quite certain that we actually and already are in that situation. Thus all sane moralists admit that one may sometimes tell a lie, but no sane moralist would ever approve of telling a little boy to practice telling lies in case he might one day have to tell a justifiable one. Thus morality has often justified shooting a robber or a burglar, but it would not justify going into the village Sunday school and shooting all the little boys who looked as if they might grow up into burglars. The need may arise, but the need must have arisen. It seems to me quite clear that if you step across this limit, you step off a precipice. Now, whether torturing an animal is or is not an immoral thing, it is at least a dreadful thing. It belongs to the order of exceptional and even desperate acts. Except for some extraordinary reason, I would not grievously hurt an animal. With an extraordinary reason, I would grievously hurt him. If, for example, a mad elephant were pursuing me and my family, and I could only shoot him so that he would die in agony, he would have to die in agony. But the elephant would be there. I would not do it to a hypothetical elephant. Now, it always seems to me that this is the one weak point in the ordinary vivisectionist argument. Suppose your wife were dying. Vivisection is not done by a man whose wife is dying. If it were, it might be lifted to the level of the moment, as would be lying or stealing bread, or any other ugly action. But this ugly action is done in cold blood, at leisure, by men who are not sure that it will be of any use to anybody. Men of whom the most that can be said is that they may conceivably make the beginnings of some discovery which may perhaps save the life of someone else's wife in some remote future. That is too cold and distant to rob an act of its immediate horror. That is like training the child to tell lies for the sake of some great dilemma that may never come to him. You are doing a cruel thing, but not with enough passion to make it a kindly one. So much for why I am an anti-vivisectionist, and I should like to say in conclusion that all other anti-vivisectionists of my acquaintance weaken their case infinitely by forming this attack on scientific speciality, in which the human heart is commonly on their side, with attacks upon universal human customs, in which the human heart is not at all on their side. I have heard humanitarians, for instance, speak of vivisection and field sports as if they were the same kind of thing. The difference seems to me simple and enormous. In sport, a man goes into a wood and mixes with the existing life of that wood, becomes a destroyer only in the simple and healthy sense in which all the creatures are destroyers, becomes for one moment to them what they are to him. Another animal. In vivisection, a man takes a simpler creature and subjects it to subtleties which no one but man could inflict on him, and for which man is therefore gravely and terribly responsible. Meanwhile, it remains true that I shall eat a great deal of turkey this Christmas, and it is not in the least true, as the vegetarians say, that I shall do it because I do not realize what I am doing, or because I do what I know is wrong, or that I do it with shame or doubt or a fundamental unrest of conscience. In one sense, I know quite well what I am doing, and in another sense, I know quite well that I know not what I do. Scrooge and the Cratchits and I are, as I have said, all in one boat. The turkey and I are, to say the most of it, ships that pass in the night, and greet each other in passing. I wish him well, but it is really practically impossible to discover whether I treat him well. I can avoid, and I do avoid with horror, all special and artificial tormenting of him, sticking pins in him for fun, or sticking knives in him for scientific investigation. But whether by feeding him slowly and killing him quickly for the needs of my brethren, I have improved in his own solemn eyes his own strange and separate destiny, whether I have made him in the sight of God a slave or a martyr, or one whom the gods love and who die young, that is far more removed from my possibilities of knowledge than the most abstruse intricacies of mysticism or theology. A turkey is more occult and awful than all the angels and archangels. In so far as God has partly revealed to us an angelic world, he has partly told us what an angel means. But God has never told us what a turkey means. And if you go and stare at a live turkey for an hour or two, you will find by the end of it that the enigma has rather increased than diminished. End of section 12. End of All Things Considered by G.K. Chesterton.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.